It's 9 o'clock. You're listening to WNYC FM 93.9, New York Public Radio. So yesterday, this guy who works here and I go down to the seaport. The guy I'm talking about is Joe Bevilacqua. We both have in common an enduring love of the Hanna-Barbera cartoons that we watched as tots. I still have my Flintstones records and played them on the air here, in fact, and I trundled those along with me, hoping for an autograph, which I got. When we went to go visit and interview Joe Barbera, one half of the Hanna-Barbera cartoon-making team. And it's been for about the last 50 years or so that Hanna-Barbera has been making cartoons with characters like Yogi Bear, Huckleberry Hound, Jetsons, the Flintstones, Quick Draw McGraw. And at times, Joe Bevilacqua has come on my programs here at WNYC to share some of his wonderful tape archive of the work of Dawes Butler, who was the voice of the majority of the Hanna-Barbera cartoon characters. Joe studied with Dawes Butler and learned a lot from him and has shared some of that wonderful taped material of the late Dawes Butler's that's in Joe Bevilacqua's collection. And it's just fun to actually visit with some of the people who made the cartoons. So we went down to the Circle Gallery at the South Street Seaport. It's on Front Street, and just yesterday was the opening of an exhibit of animation cells from Hanna-Barbera cartoons, including Jetsons the movie. And we cornered Mr. Barbera, who was actually very nice.
When Hanna-Barbera made the transition from film, from theatricals, into television, how did that come about?
Well, it was from desperation. Let me use the word. They suddenly closed the studio. We were doing the Tom and Jerry cartoons for MGM. It was an economic situation because they found out they could reissue our old cartoons and do almost as well as spending the money on a new one. They didn't have the money, so they closed the studio. So now we were out in the cold, you know, at the time that I felt I was at the pinnacle of my career, and it was very little time left before I hit the old man's home, you know. But good Lord, I mean, so now we went to television, which was in its infancy. In fact, there was a word you didn't mention at the studio because they'd fire you if you ever said television. And out of desperation, first we created a series which was called Rough and Ready, the first one we ever did.
Hey, Roth, listen at this. UFO sighted. Saucer-shaped ship seen by sheep herder. Police swamped by telephone calls. Hey, Roth, what's a UFO?
Not UFO, you goofo. That's UFO, unidentified flying object. Oh, any dope would know that.
Well, here's one dope that didn't. Gee, maybe it's a real flying-type saucer. Don't go away. They don't call me ready for nothing.
Secondly, we went to a company called Screen Gems that was a subsidiary of Columbia. They were thinking of animation, but they laughed when you talked about the cost of animation. They said, forget it, we can't do it. So we devised what has since become known as limited animation. Limited, if people would understand by one thing, money. If you have the money, you do full animation. You spend the money, make more drawings. Without it, you create a whole new art form, which fortunately worked. I mean, I go to Chicago with a show called Huckleberry Hound, which had Yogi Bear in it and the cat that hated the Mises to pieces.
Dog, howdy. This here's your old prestidigitator, Huckleberry Hound. A prestidigitator, now that's a highfalutin word for old black magic. For instance, I can take a plain old silk hat, tap it light-like, and presto, Pixie and Dixie.
Hiya, folks. Hiya.
We're going to see them later in a Pixie and Dixie cartoon. And we'll see Hocus Pocus up, boy. My Hocus Pocus is out of focus. Down, boy. Mr. Jinx.
Yours truly and person-like, you know.
And another fella we'll be seeing right soon. Yogi Bear there.
And how do you do to you?
And now, this is Huckleberry Hound saying, see you soon in a Huck cartoon.
did it in that kind of animation, limited, and got as many laughs as we ever had before in the actual Tom and Jerry. They screamed and they bought the show.
But now, how did you compensate for the fact that you didn't have the full animation?
We were actually able to put over the business, but by using the knowledge you had of 20 years of animation, and by using the drawings and by timing it correctly, we were able to get the same effect as full animation. In fact, what was beginning to happen in animation was overkill in animation. Too much animation. People weren't impressed anymore by the fact that a drop of water would ripple across a pond, or that this field of flowers would blow in the wind. You'd animate all that stuff. Didn't mean anything anymore. The idea is, what was the business, what were the stories, and what was the humor? And we happened to fortunately hit on a formula where we really use pretty sophisticated humor. I mean, we never lost a kid. We never aimed them at children, never aimed them at adults. We just did what we called family entertainment, and it worked.
But now, the Tom and Jerry's were silent, really. They were music, sound effects, they didn't talk, and now you had to make that transition where you had a lot of dialogue. How did you do that?
Well, you're absolutely correct. The Tom and Jerry's never had any voice with them, except a loud scream when Tom has, when a safe fell on Tom once in a while. But we suddenly, I found myself in a position of having to go out and sell the new cartoons that we were creating. And we never had to do that before. So suddenly I find myself on planes flying to Chicago, to New York, to trying to pitch shows to them. And suddenly looking for something we never had to do before, and that was voices. And when we began looking for voices, into the scene came a gentleman called Dawes Butler. Now, this little fella came in, and you'd say, well, look, I want a Southern voice, if I can get one. Put a little edge of Southern on his voice, not a Brooklyn or a New York, a Southern. Well, he'd take about a half hour. He'd take you into the Northern Southern. The North Carolina would be like that, and South. Go over to Atlanta, we go...
Now, I'm doing a Southern character. I mean, that's what Huck is. He's based on all the Southern people I ever saw in my life. All. And I just have a little loop going through that that three-letter word, A-L-L. It's not a diphthong. All. It's almost a diphthong. All. Like two syllables instead of one. I did. That's a diphthong. I did.
He did. All these variations, and you have to pick one, you know? And he'd love to do that. Now, Dawes would get on a soundstage. Now, here I have never been involved with a voice man or had to direct anything. I'm directing it, and he's on a soundstage, and he's reading a script, and he will take nine voices. He will do, when I say nine, he'll only do key voices, but also will give the man that comes in and says, oh, right, wait there.
It's probably
a
party line. Answer the door, Blab.
What did it say, Snoop?
Hey, what's going on here? I am Quick Draw McGraw, and as foreman, I have the right to know.
Tell you what, Quick Draw, you can be Blab's assistant.
An assistant with an assistant. What a system.
Hey, Bubba Louie, you could be the assistant assistant's assistant. Say.
See.
So?
So, let's look for the ghost.
Then he teamed up with Don Messick, and they became Yogi and Boo Boo. Right. Yogi was the brash con bear. How do you do, sir? I am a starving woodland creature. I would like a crust of bread. He says a pecan pie or a chocolate cake. And
this is pretty good living, eh, Boo-Boo?
I like our cave better, Yogi.
We'll call room service and have some picnic baskets sent up.
And Booba would say, Yogi, I don't think the Ranger's gonna like that. And he'd say, hey, Yogi, hey, Booba, what the Ranger don't see can't hurt, you know, Booba boy, you know. All that. So he would be doing all this stuff.
Now, when he did those, and when Don Messick and Dawes Butler were working together, did they frequently do them straight through as if it was a live radio show without a lot of editing?
Oh, yeah. The only stops would be where I thought they should either accent something more or pick up the tempo. And I would just stop the recording by just pressing a button and say, wait a minute, let's do a pickup at this particular line. I say, and I say, when you do it, I say, let's say, hey, Yogi, keep going over there like that. Instead of you said, I said, you'd be too slow. I said, you said, hey, Yogi, let's pick, keep going or hold it. And there was no excitement in your voice, so let's pick it up. Line two, take one, boom, we pick up. And just keep right on rolling. We got through, we had a finished shot.
Only been gone 2 minutes, and I'm homesick for the park already. Open it up!
Some of the Hanna-Barbera cartoons in the late 50s and early 60s were much more gentle. They had a gentler quality than the Tom and Jerry's or the Warner Brothers things or the things that Tex Avery did. Was that a conscious decision?
Well, it could be that when we were doing Tom and Jerry, which were all pantomime, and I can go back and say, like, when Chaplin was doing stuff, he had a lot of real, I'll use the word, hard, depending not only on the situations, the stories, and they were more situation comedy-oriented, but also the personality of the characters. And the personalities brought out different directions, which you don't do when you're chasing somebody. You don't stop to change a direction or, you know, suddenly you change your personality. You don't do that. Mm-hmm. See, Yogi could take on any role. He could be brash. He could plead with some poor innocent camper to give him his picnic basket, you know, and all that stuff. Mm-hmm.
Dawes told me that you were a very good director. And yes. And he said that you really focused him in on a lot of the dialogue and how to say the lines, and he said you could do a lot of the characters yourself, and he said your favorite character was Snagglepuss.
Oh, yeah, Snagglepuss. Well, I gotta tell you, Dawes did that, right? Mm-hmm. And I had a writer who knew the expressions, like, for instance, this writer...
Mike Maltese.
Yeah, Mike Maltese was wonderful. He loved the character. Just a minute. Suffering Murgatroyd. Exit. Stage left. Or up even, you know what I mean? And this kind of stuff, we would be rolling on the floor.
That is a lot of bunk.
Sooner we find them right mattress, the richer we get quick.
Or vice versa. But right now, I'm hungry.
Me too.
So exit, stage delicatessen, drooling all the way.
Now that's the difference in the Tom and Jerry. You see, we were laughing at their attitudes and their dialogue. And there was no reason to bash anybody on the head with a frying pan and that kind of stuff, you know?
Yeah.
But we had a dog that worked with Quick Draw McGraw.
Snuffle.
I think, Muff, yeah.
Snuffle.
Snuffles, I want you to get real ferocious and snarling. And go flush out that rustling bar mint. Cat.
Well, he was a two-faced dog. Do you remember his routine?
Uh-huh.
He wouldn't do anything unless they gave him a dog biscuit. He'd go, and he says, so Quick Draw would say, no way, you're going to get another dog biscuit. And he'd go, well, he just shrugged and he's not going to move. Okay, here's another dog biscuit. And he'd go off and he'd meet the heavy. And the heavy would give him three dog biscuits, right? To double-cross the sheriff, see? I got to tell you, kids would come in and hug themselves and imitate that dog, you know?
And that dog didn't even have any lines to say.
No. He was just his attitude. The funniest thing was when Quick Draw McGraw trying to figure out what was the ecstasy that he got out of the dog biscuits.
Wonder what they see in them dog biscuits.
Search me, Quick Draw.
Well, there's only one way to find out.
Looked around when nobody looked. Floated in the air.
I think Quistra is not only brave, he's also bashful.
And he had an expression where Baba Louie would say, hey, Quistra, I seen that. He said, hold on there. I do the thinning around here, you know.
You do those so well. It's just amazing. You should have been doing voices yourself.
I got into it because it would help me cue them, you know, to pick it up or get what I particularly wanted.
So Now, with the Flintstones, how did that come about? And I know that was the first primetime show. How did you get into doing that?
Well, our sales man, John Mitchell, came in one day and said, why don't we try to do a primetime nighttime show, which no one even had dreamed of or dared. So we did endless drawings trying to create a family. You know, nothing was ringing. We tried like a father with a business suit and a mother who was shorter and a little rounder and maybe a teenage son and a dog. Then we went to overalls and country and hillbilly family, right? Then we went to athletic stuff, athletic gear and sneakers and things. Nothing was registering until one day, and I wish I could remember exactly, or even say I did it, whatever it was, a guy named Ed Benedict was drawing the characters, and we arrived, we just had to go caveman. So we went to the caveman family. Well, once we did that, a piano became a Stoneway piano, right? And that began to roll. We went on a roll. We had the Stoneway piano. We had the Polar Rock camera. We had Ann Marg Rock did a guest spot for us. She came in and did it. We had Cary Grant. We had Stoney Curtis.
Around school, I was known as Fireball Freddy.
Yeah, no kidding. I always thought you majored in hooky.
Keep it up, pal, and you'll find yourself walking to work. Limping.
Oh, Fred, I'm sorry, Fred. I was only kidding.
The cars had no gasoline, so they did them with their feet. You know, they wind up their feet. And then we would concentrate once in a while. We'd do a cut to the brakes being put on, which was the heels of their feet, and then you see smoke coming out. Mm-hmm. And if we had a plane going to Rock Vegas, we'd have this structure tied together with the bamboo or whatever, and there's four birds, two on each wing, and they start flapping their wings in a takeoff. And Barney was sitting in the economy class, which is on the tail of the plane, you know, outside, with the wind blowing, you know. And these gags, this stuff was, an adult could get it right away and chuckle, and a kid would love it. So we were combining, and then the story was good.
Hey, you the desk nurse?
No, I'm Lady Godiva, and this is the kissing booth.
I got no time for amateur comedians. Where is Mr. Rubble's room?
He's in 102. Who are you, Fatso? A deceased relative or something?
No, I'm a deceased pal, and I gotta see him.
Sorry, Buster.
Were you conscious of the fact at the time that you were initially, and then, of course, you were going on doing it further, but initially parodying the Honeymooners?
Oh, let's put it this way. This comes up every so often. What I feel is that when there's a show on the air somewhere that's a hit, depending on who's first or not, the fall-offs happen. I mean, for instance, you remember when Cosby started, there were at least two more shows that started with other black couples and families that didn't work. And if there's a doctor show or a lawyer show, there's about six more offsprings of those that come up that work. Now, you can say that that's what we did, but we really didn't do that deliberately. We were more fascinated with the Stone Age gimmicks than doing a Honeymooner show. We had two couples, yeah. Then we did something that never happened before. We had a baby, which was unbelievable. I mean, it caused a sensation. They sold 3 million of those Pebbles dolls in 2 months. And they called me and they said, hey, we hear you're going to have a baby. I said, yeah. They said, what is it going to be? I said, a boy. What else would I think of, you know? Little did I know, they really don't make boy dolls. Mm-hmm. Right. He said, well, listen, we have the ideal toy people here, and could you make it a girl? Because they really would like to get involved with it. I said, geez, I'm going to have to think about that. Yes. But what was curious one time was that we were recording the show, and Alan Reed was, I should mention that I did do the first five shows with two other stars.
Oh, really?
Hal Smith and somebody else. I forget the name of that gentleman. He was very good, but there was something I didn't feel was right. So I went back and got Mel Blanc and Alan Reed, and they really did it. One time I was recording a show, and I'm up in the booth, and I'm marking my script, and they're down on the floor with the microphone. They're marking their scripts. give you an example. I want to give you an example of our brilliance and our creativity. Alan Reed yells up, "Hey, Joe." And I said, "Yeah." And I'm marking away. He says, "It says Yahoo here." I said, "Yeah." He says, "Can I say yep?" I said, "Yep." I'd give you an idea how quick I was on my feet. You know? Absolutely brilliant. And I said, "Yes, I thought of that whole thing."
What kinds of things are you going to be doing in the future that you might want to tell us about?
Tell you, I think it's complementary to the efforts of everyone involved with the Flintstones that 30 years later, Spielberg and Dick Donner and myself are heavily involved in a live-action major feature. And they even talked about casting with Goodman, you know, and Danny DeVito with Bonnie. All that dialogue's been going on. And we're also involved in getting the script ready for the Johnny Quest show, which is a big cult show that is. People love it. There's a major motion picture live. Mm-hmm. And also, I have the Green Hornet that I'm developing. It's a major motion picture. So all this stuff is moving forward. And the new Tom and Jerry show I'm doing 50 years later, I'm doing the Tom and Jerry Kids. And really just as popular as ever, thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Joe Barbera.
An interview conducted just yesterday. I was in the room, didn't have much to say. Joe Bevilacqua was conducting the interview with Joseph Barbera, one half of the Hanna-Barbera cartoon team. And we'll be... Well, I really liked that. I thought Joe produced that. Joe Bevilacqua produced that. Didn't he do a nice job?